I think I mentioned to you, and if I did, well, I'll repeat it, that my mother's father was chosen as a member of the BILU, B-I-L-U, in 1881 or 1882, to go to Palestine, to then southern Syria, but that's the area called Palestine now.
It was southern Syria then?
It was southern Syria then, that's right. It was southern Syria then, to go there and really reestablish the Jewish state. Everybody thinks it started with Herzl. It did not start with Herzl. It started with the BILU, and the BILU was organized in the area around Vilna, which was the most highly cultured Jewish life in Europe in the 1880s. 19 people were chosen, and by the way, the Jewish Encyclopedia tells this whole story under BILU. 19 people were chosen to go to the area around Jerusalem to actually build a colony. Prior to that, for the past 2,000 years, Jews went back to Jerusalem and the area of Jerusalem to die or to study, but never to recreate the state. But in 1881 or 82, after the Tsar Alexander II had been assassinated, and there were pogroms all over Eastern Europe, a group was picked, 18 men and one woman, of whom my mother's father, who was a rather wealthy Jew, to go back there and start an actual colony in order to start building colonies to recreate the state. When they got as far as Constantinople, and when they got to Constantinople, the Sultan of Turkey had heard about this, and he issued an ukaz in which he said that if any one of those is caught landing anywhere in the area of southern Syria, they'll be killed immediately.
I'm going to have to stop you for a minute.
Ready? Okay. When the Sultan of Turkey issued this ukaz, he'll kill any Jew that's landing there, four of them defected. And 15 of them, 14 men and one woman went on. And they agreed to meet somewhere outside of, around Jerusalem, but not in Jerusalem because they knew they would get caught. But they got together, 14 men and one woman, of which my grandfather was one, and they founded Rishon LeZion. That's the first Jewish colony, meaning the first in Zion.
How's that spelled?
Rishon LeZion, just called.
R-I-S-H-O-N.
It's a Hebrew word. It's R-I-S-H-O-N, L, apostrophe Z-I-O-N. That's the Hebrew word for the first in Zion. And from then on, Jews started to create colonies in preparation for the recreation of the Jewish state. It took on a political aspect with the Dreyfus case in France, and then Theodor Herzl tried to organize the political arrangements that might later on give rise to a state. But it wasn't until the Balfour Declaration in 1917 that Chaim Weizmann really laid the political foundation for the recreation of a Jewish state. My grandfather, who left Vilna and left his wife and four daughters behind, of which my mother was the eldest, and she was only 6 years old, and she did not know, she did not ever, I asked her many, many times, she did not remember her father. He left the four daughters, of whom my mother was six, and there was one four, two, and a baby. But he was quite well-to-do, and his widow then remarried, and the stepfather raised these four daughters.
But what happened to your grandfather?
Pardon? That's my mother's father, my grandfather.
When he went to Israel?
In 1882.
He left them.
He left them behind in Vilna. Never came, they never saw him again.
His grandmother. But did he live?
No, I'll tell you that story. Okay. My grandfather only lasted 2 or 3 years after he arrived there. And they started working by starting this colony. And he died. When he died, he was the first of the group to die. And they decided that this has to be a sacred place where he is buried. And so they buried him on the Mount of Olives. And they built a wall around the cemetery in which only BILU members will be buried. The Chevra Kadisha in Jerusalem have the entire history of this. My grandfather's name, he did not have a surname, was Avraham Ben Boruch, Abraham the son of Boruch, HaKohen. He was a Kohen.
Avraham priest. Ben
Boruch. Now, he gave them all very important names. Why? Avraham and Abraham, and Baruch means blessing. If the oldest son if the oldest child was a son, he was always called Baruch, means blessing. Okay? And the Chevra Kadisha of Jerusalem have pictures of the grave and have the entire history of my grandfather under the name of Avraham ben Baruch HaKohen. In 1921, as soon as World War I was over, my parents sent my brother, who had graduated from Yale in 1919, to go back to Vilna and to find out after World War I whether there were any relatives of my mother and father left. They had all been killed in World War I. And from then on, people don't know that.
Oh, tell us more about that.
We don't know. We couldn't find any. My brother couldn't find anybody in these villages, see. And I must say, I'll tell you a word about my father first. There was a tradition in this elitist intellectual group around Vilna that the smartest yeshiva bochers, the smartest young Jews who were studying to be rabbis, after their bar mitzvah, for the rich families to take them in and give them room and board and pay the tuition. My mother's stepfather took in my father when he was 14 years old to be a student in Vilna, in the big yeshiva. My mother was a half year older than my father. And when my father was 19 years old, and my mother was 19 and a half years old, the Lithuanian government wanted to draft my father into the army and send them to Siberia or somewhere like that. And my father married my mother, when they sort of grew up together, married my mother, and went across the Baltic Sea to Hamburg. This was the path. He was only trained to be a rabbinic student, so he wasn't trained. He had no profession or no skills of any kind. So he worked in a sweatshop in Hamburg. And he worked there for about 6 months until he saved enough money to go from them there to Eastcheap in London. That was the next step, where the poor Jews who were en route to America went to London. And in London, he did exactly the same thing in Eastcheap in London, as he worked for 6-7 months in a sweatshop there too, making men's work clothes and things of this kind. And then he left for America. In those days, this is before there's an Ellis Island, they landed in Baltimore.
This is your father.
My father landed. He left his mother, he left my wife behind, his wife behind, and he landed in Baltimore. And in Baltimore again, he worked in a sweatshop. And then from then, he knew of a young fellow, who was a friend of his, who had moved into Hopkinsville, Kentucky. And my father joined him first to work for me. He opened a small grocery store or something like that, see. When my father was in Hopkinsville, he heard, or he read in the papers, that at Cincinnati, Ohio, they had started what he thought was a yeshiva to train rabbis. It was the Hebrew Union College. He had never heard of Reform Judaism or Conservative Judaism. He only knew Orthodox Judaism. But he went to Cincinnati, and he talked to the first president of the Hebrew Union College by the name of Kaufman Kohler. Kaufman Kohler was so impressed with my father's knowledge of Talmud and the Bible and Jewish history and all that kind of stuff. He said, look here, he said, I'll tell you what, he said, why don't you go to, he explained this new religion to him. And my father was very much taken with the new religion called Reform Judaism. And he says to him, you can work your way through, you can be a teacher, because you can teach all these subjects just as well as anybody we have here, and you can study, and you can become a Reform rabbi, and I'll bring your wife over. My father then wrote my mother a long letter explaining this whole thing to her, and my mother wrote him back and said, never mind this new religion. If you want this new religion, I'll divorce you. I'm not coming. My father then decided to give it up. He got a job in another sweatshop in Cincinnati, you know. But being, then he was about 20 years, a little over 20 years old, you know. And he was very ambitious and he was young. And he soon became a foreman in the sweatshop. And he brought my mother over and so on.
What year did your mother come?
About a year or two after that. I would say we don't know exactly. We think it's around 1890, 1889, 1891. They kept the Jewish calendar, and the Jewish calendar did not correspond with our calendar, see. But I'm going to tell you this. This November, this October the 13th to the 15th of this year, is the 100th anniversary of my father and mother's wedding. And the Lowenthals are having a tremendous reunion. Outside of O'Hare Airport, we rented the entire motel for 3 days, the entire motel. And already there are 91 acceptances of descendants of Philip and Jenny Lowenthal. My father went to Germany. He took on a surname, because he had to have a surname, and he was a Levite. And they called him Levins and Leventhals. And then he left the umlaut off, over and he became Lowenthal, see? And that's how he does it. So anyway, I wanted to just tell you that. I have been the paterfamilias since 1945 of my family. My father and mother had eight children. I am the second oldest. My older brother, who went to Yale, a year before me. He died in 1945. My father and mother had already died. And I have been the oldest member of the family since 1945. I am the paterfamilias. And I set the pattern for all the Lowenthals. And I want to tell you about that a little bit. In the first place, my brother Ben, class of 1919, Yale, was the marshal of his class. He was the valedictorian of his class at Yale University. I was associate editor of the Yale Law Journal. And my son went to Exeter, entered Harvard before he was 15, when he was 15 years old.
Really?
Oh, yes.
What is your son's name?
I'll tell you about him. But my son, when he was a senior at Exeter Academy, he'd been Exeter, Phillips Exeter Academy, which is the finest prep school in the United States, as you know, he won the National Mathematics Prize. And then my daughter went to Harvard, because Yale wasn't taking girls those days. My daughter went, and my daughter won Phi Beta Kappa in her junior year at Harvard, the top 1% of the class. 16 out of the 1,600. We don't know whether she was first or 16th. She got her Phi Beta Kappa in her junior year. And she's now a professor of history. And my son is shall I say, a leading man in so-called computer software for General Electric. It's wrong. But I wanted to put that into the record. My daughter also is, shall I say, one of the leading persons with reference to the history of the Holocaust. And as a historian, she has produced half a dozen documents for the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And
this
she,
is Mary Felsner.
That's Mary Lowenthal Felsner. That's her name. That's right. And has just attended at Oxford University the greatest assemblies of scholars on the Holocaust, because it's the 40th anniversary of the State of Israel and the Holocaust and so on and so forth. And she delivered a very important paper which has been published and so on and so forth. But I just wanted to mention that.
Your son's name is?
My son's John. Is John Nolan. Well, that's correct.
And he's living now, where now?
John Nolan lives in New York City, and he's with General Electric. Been with General Electric for 14 years. Anyway, I want to go back now to some of my Yale experiences. I gave you some of them. I entered Yale in 1916.
I think we covered that pretty
now,
well.
Some of them, but not all of them. Okay. I want to add something to it.
Okay.
That's right, we did. I want to add two things. Yale, at that time, as did Harvard, had very small Jewish quotas in those days, and maintained those quotas until after World War II, until after the State of Israel, until 1950, maintained those quotas. And there were very few Jews at Yale in my day. However, after the Balfour Declaration in 1917, I entered Yale in 1916, I became interested in it, and Louis Brandeis, who was then, Judge Brandeis was then on the Supreme Court, we called him the provisional head of the Zionist organization, because in 1907, he had put together all these nationality Zionist, like the Ukrainian Jews had a Zionist organization, and the Lithuanian Jews had one, and if they came from a certain city, from Odessa, they had a synagogue, and they had a Zionist organization. My father put those together into Chovevi Tzion, the Lovers of Zion, organized them all, and when Brandeis in 1917 decided to create the Zionist Organization of America and institute what Theodore Herzl started in 1897, my father merged Chovevi Tzion into the ZOA. And so I tell you all this because I come by all this very, very naturally. Therefore, I got to know Brandeis and Frankfurter and Cardoza and Abe Fortas and Arthur Goldberg. All five Jewish members of the United States Supreme Court I have known in my life. I want you to know that. I'm probably the only guy alive. I knew all five Jewish members of the United States Supreme Court. Now, when I entered Yale in 1916, there were very few Jewish members, but there was one there who took entrance exams when I took them. His name was Charles Rosenblum of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Charles Rosenblum came from a very, very wealthy family.
Is that B-L-O-O-M?
B-L-O-O-M. Charles J. Rosenblum. He was the son of Saul Rosenblum. And Saul Rosenblum was not only one of the biggest liquor men in the world, he owned maybe 20 or 25 distilleries. But when the Volstead Act came in and the United States went dry, instead of moving into Canada or bootlegging, he decided to sell everything. But by that time, this is 1921, by that time, his son took the exams with me and became my closest friend at Yale for all 4 years that I was at Yale. He became my closest friend. And when I graduated from Yale, his father wanted to set his son up in the banking business and asked me if I would be his partner. And in that way, Rosenblum and Lowenthal was founded, investment bankers and investment securities. That was my business. Although I graduated from the Yale College and Yale Law School, and I said I was on the editorial staff of the Yale Law Journal, I never took a bar exam because I was the second oldest of these eight children. And me, my brother, and I, and my father had the idea that my sister had to go to Smith and my other brothers had to go to Yale and so on and so forth. And we had to go to work right away. So, you know, lawyers in those days, graduate lawyers, weren't being paid very much. So on. So anyway, I want to now go back to my experiences at Yale. At Yale, I had no idea, because I came from this small town in Kentucky, what an elitist institution is like. My classmates, and I want to mention some of them, were as follows. To this very day, as a matter of fact, next week, on September the 10th, it's the 90th birthday of Seymour Knox. I am like a member of the family of Seymour Knox. Seymour Knox is the main heir of the Ward fortune, Wards. And he was chairman of the board for 30 or 40 years of the 10th biggest bank in the world. He was the chairman of the board of he harnessed Niagara Hudson Power Company, supplies it all, the power for all these people. He and I have maintained the closest friendship since 1916. It was a strange coincidence. He was about a quarter of an inch taller than I am, and my classmates called him Shorty Knox, and I was Shorty Lowenthal. And then at Yale was the first university, and we hadn't entered World War I yet, that established the Students' Army Training Corps, which is the forerunner of the
ROTC,
that's right. So fortunately for me,
What was that called?
It was called the Students' Army Training Corps. And fortunately for me, entered Yale, they put you in uniform, see? So I looked like the rest of my classmates. They didn't realize. But they all knew I was working my way through because I waited on the table, see? So I worked my way, and here, Cornelius Vanderbilt Whitney was a classmate of mine. Hugh Auchincloss, the stepfather of Jackie Kennedy, was a classmate of mine. Henry Luce was a classmate of mine. Thornton Wilder was a classmate of mine. Reginald Marsh, the great painter, was a class, and I knew them all intimately all my life. I want to stress that. I visited Thornton Wilder when he was sick at Martha's Vineyard. The week before he died, he wrote me a letter. I'm the biggest collector of Thornton Wilder. I have everything he wrote autographed by him, corrected by him, and so on and so forth. I have all of this. So on. And these people affected my life, changed my life. But there was another thing that affected my life that I have to talk about. And that is, when I was studying law at Yale, William Howard Taft, who had been president of the United States, then became the professor of constitutional law at Yale. And I was his student. And he at that time was the world head of the League to Enforce Peace, which then became the League of Nations. And because I didn't have any rich fathers, uncles, and relatives who had big law firms in New York or were the chairman of the board of a large corporation or anything like that, the only out for me was to study, to be a teacher of law. And then when William Howard Taft came along, he said to me, why don't you prepare yourself for the League to Enforce Peace, which then became the League of Nations. So I studied conflict of law, international law, philosophy of law, things of this kind, as against the very practical things that I absolutely was totally unprepared for the practice law. I was prepared for the teaching of law or to go with some international organization. But when I graduated, Charles Roosevelt's father said to me, I want you to go. He liked me, because he used to come up and visit New Haven. He'd have to take me to lunch and so on. He said, I'd like to have you go in partnership with Charles. I'll put up all the money, see. And so he did. He put up the money, and I learned we did very well right in the beginning. And I learned very soon in my life that you don't make money. I didn't know anything about investment. Money made money, and the money made the money, please believe me. And so it wasn't very long that my sister then, who was 2 years behind me, and then she was at Smith College already, you see, and so on, she was working her way through too. But by the time the fourth one came on, my younger brother entered Yale in the class of 1924, 25, we were already, he didn't have to work his way through anymore. We were already set. And so we set up these trusts for all the low and falls, to go to the boys to go to Yale and the girls to go to Smith. And we moved, when my sister went to Smith, she learned all these ways of the rich. And my brother and I bought my father a fancy house in Avondale of Cincinnati. And this is the way the low and falls progressed. We moved out all
that quickly.
That quickly. It was very quick.
What kind of business were
investment banking business, that's right.
But you said you weren't prepared for that. How did you?
The money made. We had so much money behind us.
I see.
We bought the Falk Company, and we bought all kinds of companies.
So you
and
managed
sold
this?
Them. We financed them.
Financed them.
We built Webster Hall, for example. We financed Webster Hall, one of our companies. We financed these apartment houses. We built a hotel in Detroit, and. We had the Falk Company, it was a chemical company, and so on and so forth. We had banks. We had all kinds of things like that, see. And my brothers then went to the banking business, too, see. My brother, older brother, went to Cincinnati. And then later on, my younger brother in Nashville, and so on and so forth. Yeah. But anyway, I wanted to get this on the record, because it's very unusual. But at the same time, my sister took the first course at Smith College ever given in art appreciation. But she not only studied art appreciation, she studied art itself. And when she graduated from Smith, my father then said to me, I should take her.
What was her sister's name?
Rachel. By the way, all the Lowenthals have names that are biblical names, see. And there's my brother Ben, the older one who graduated from Yale, his name was Ben, but his name was Boruch, because that's the Hebrew name for the oldest of the sons, see? And my name is Eliyahu Yehuda.
Oh.
That's my Hebrew name, is Eliyahu Yehuda. And my sister's name is Rachel, and my next brother is Moshe. Down the line, it's this way, you see.
I understand she's the one who got you all started in art.
My brother, and she's the one who started me in art, that's right. Why? She went to Europe first, and then the next sister took the same courses and also studied art.
What was her name?
Her name was Lancy. Anyway, I took her to Europe then, see. And here, we went to the Louvre, for example, she says, that's Tintoretto, and that's Tintoretto. My little sister was telling me all these things. So I decided I better study art. So I studied art, studied painting. That's one of my copies of that right there. And I studied art history, and I came to Pittsburgh. And when I came to Pittsburgh, every year they used to have these Carnegie International Exhibition of Art. So I went to that when I came here at the end of 1921. I looked around, and I knew they were the finest. Every artist said his best, and it was the second best international exhibition in the world. The Venice Biennale was the best one, and the Carnegie International, which was founded a year later in 1896, was the second best one. But anyway, I went there, and I had an interest in it, and so on and so forth. And I found these things are for sale.
Louder and slowly, more slowly and louder, please.
I found that these things were for sale. So then in 1922, when I went, I bought a painting. And since I never was very sure of myself, I always felt, well, this is the best place to go. Why? because the screening of the paintings, because they wanted to show the best in the world, you know, of modern art, and every artist wanted to always submit his best one. Why? Because if he won a prize, he became world famous right then and there. And so at first I confined myself to buying only the prizes, because I wasn't ever sure enough of myself. Then I found out there was a Venice Biennale, which was antedated this. So I went to the Venice Biennale every 2 years, and I bought paintings of the Venice Biennale, and I bought paintings. And when Sao Paulo set up a Biennale, I went to Sao Paulo, because it was all the same theory, see? And I always try to buy paintings that were reproduced in the catalog, because I only reproduced the best ones. And if they won some kind of prize or a mention or something like that, see? And that's the way we collected. So,
why don't you tell us about some of your art now?
Among the things that I collected, I do want to tell you that. I collected art, but I